From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Mary Wollstonecraft, the 18th century English feminist, wrote, "I do not wish women to have power over men, but over themselves." Is Wollstonecraft's aphorism consistent with feminism today? Does it reflect the aims of feminist writers and social critics? Addressing those and related questions, Soundings now presents the final segment in a series of conversations about women's literary studies. My guest is Elaine Showalter, professor of English at Rutgers University and a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. Elaine Showalter's books include Women's Liberation and Literature and A Literature of Their Own, a study of British women novelists. Professor Showalter is presently a member of the editorial board of the forthcoming edition of the Cambridge History of American Literature. Let's begin with a very general question. What is it that connects feminist theory or feminism to literature in America in the 1980s?
Well, there are a lot of places where I could start to answer that question. Perhaps from a personal perspective to begin with, when I first got involved in the women's liberation movement, which was in the late 1960s, women writers were very prominent as leaders in the movement. And one of the things that was unusual about feminist criticism when it began in women's studies was that, unlike other areas of contemporary criticism, which had become quite abstract, we were very much connected with an ongoing literary practice. Women writers, women poets like Adrienne Rich, short story writers like Tilly Olson and Grace Paley, novelists like Toni Morrison, were among the women who spoke out with us on the platforms, at conferences, not only conferences about literature, but conferences about the status of women. They were leaders. They were models for us as presences, as well as in their published works. So there was a real sense of solidarity between women in universities who had been trained in literary criticism and women who were creative artists. Secondly, I think that there are historical reasons why feminism should inevitably have focused on women's writing and on the problem of literature. Literature or writing was, of course, one of the first professions available to women outside the home. It was compatible with women's roles within the home. It was something that they could do without leaving the house. It was something that, under the guise of anonymity or under a pseudonym, they could disguise or protect or conceal. It was cheap. The Brontes and Virginia Woolf talk about how it was easy to get pen and paper, whereas there were other kinds of professional training that were much harder and more expensive for women to obtain. So it was a place where women had very early found a platform and a voice. And thirdly, I think, and this is the most important reason, it was through fiction, through poetry, through literary texts of all kinds, that the ideas of feminism had been spread, much more so than through political activism. I think the novels of Charlotte Bronte, the novels of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and in our time, bestsellers by women like Erica Jong and Judith Rosner, reached a much wider audience and touched a much wider audience of women, political activism within the National Organization for Women or within various political branches of the women's movement in this country or abroad. And this has been true for a long time. It's a very powerful, radicalizing mode, literature.
How has this reached the American public? Do you find a congenial home for the sorts of writing that you have been describing in John and Jane Doe Citizen?
Yeah, I think so, because there are so many different levels of literature that are accessible to American readers. And I think there are a lot of interesting aspects to that. For one thing, women are really the audience for literature of all kinds in this country, especially for fiction, certainly for poetry. There's always been a cultural stereotype, goes back to to Mark Twain and Huck Finn that it's going to be women who are the caretakers of culture, women who are the consumers of culture, who are the ones who buy novels, who are the ones who read and write poetry. So that at every level, there is a kind of literature available that circulates. And I've often thought that the United States has a tremendous advantage in this respect. It's one of the reasons I think that the women's cause is much more advanced in the mm-hmm. United States than anywhere else, I think, in Europe. Because we do have this ability to reach, to communicate with an enormous public through fiction, through literary modes, many of them popular modes. Even something like Harlequin romances, this mm-hmm. despised genre, which sell millions and millions of copies. In the past 10 years, the heroine of the Harlequin romances has become a much more daring figure than she used to be. She started out as someone who was a traditional feminine romantic figure interested only in her man and her clothes. And as the women's movement has had impact on this country, that heroine has become radicalized. She works. She's much more interested in education. She thinks for herself. She has different demands to make from a romantic relationship. And those novels, which are read by so many millions of women from all kinds of backgrounds, themselves say something about the nature of American women today mm-hmm. and their strength.
How would you characterize the goals of women who are active in the academy regarding literature and who are also feminists? What are they after?
It's, I think, one of the most unusual positions within the academy now, and one of the happiest. I think, too, that feminists, most of us, feel that we have a particular responsibility to our women students, to open opportunities to them, to demonstrate how these opportunities might be used. We certainly have responsibility to our male students mm-hmm. to change their minds, because it's not going to be a one-sided transformation is never going to take place. Also, that we feel that we can't separate our feminism from the way we conduct our lives politically or morally, that we are connected to women who work within the university where we are in other categories, women who are secretaries, women who are doing service jobs for the university, that they're experiences are important, that we mm-hmm. need to be sure they're represented in the literature that we teach, and that we have a responsibility that we share with them.
How has all of this, you've been discussing feminism in the academy, particularly women who are interested in literature, how has all of this been received by what you might call the old boy network, the white males who have traditionally run university English departments and literature departments?
It's changing. We've now been around for about 15 years. Mm-hmm. We were all, of course, trained by those men. So we don't come from someplace else. And we all knew we had learned a great deal from them. I think in the beginning, there was hostility from some. Sometimes a lot of hostility. There was also indifference. The indifference was harder to deal with than the hostility, especially because we were so excited about the work we were doing. We felt that it was so important. It developed very, very quickly from the early essays and articles that were empirical to quite sophisticated theoretical work that's being done now. And many feminist scholars complained that men refused to listen, refused to read our work, dismissed it out of hand as something that wasn't important. Now we're seeing something very different. Now we're beginning to see some of the most distinguished male theorists, many of the most prominent men in the field, turning to feminist criticism and theory in their own work. And oddly enough, this isn't a situation that's made everyone completely happy either.
Mm-hmm. Elaine, you say that many male scholars are turning to feminist literary theory. The Academy is notorious for its trendiness,
yes.
For the ups and downs, the big ideas that come and go, and the little ideas that come and go. Is feminism in that sense just another trend in literature in the academy?
No, it absolutely isn't. I think it's one of the really fundamental paradigm shifts that's taken place in literary studies in this century. It offers anyone in cultural work a tremendous opportunity. And I said before that I feel enormously lucky, really blessed, to have come of age during this period, because the great curse of working in literary studies is so much of it has been done before, and often by people who were brilliant. It's hard to feel always, as Harold Bloom says, belated that everything has been said by someone who knew it better than you did. Mm-hmm. And women's studies has opened up this vast, unexplored territory, really a very American metaphor, the frontier. Mm-hmm. There it all is, all of that beautiful golden land that no one has ever worked with seriously before. And here's a generation of scholars, or initially women scholars, who had access to all of this work. No one had ever read it mm-hmm. seriously, or thought about it, or synthesized it, or taught it, or reprinted it, or edited it. So we are given, for a scholar, the greatest treasure of all, untapped material. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I think it will not be exhausted as primary work for a very long time. But it also requires changing the basic concepts of the field. It's anomalous work. It doesn't fit with the structures of the discipline as they've been established to deal with male writers. And so everything has to be rethought. That isn't a trend. This isn't a kind of footnote that's been tacked on to mm-hmm. a field and that can easily be discarded again. As it develops, it involves complete rethinking of everything that we've learned.
You said a few minutes ago, Elaine, that feminism is inseparable from your lives.
Yes.
As feminists, what happens when literature meets ideology? How does feminism and literature how do they connect in that sense?
There are different ways we could talk about this. First of all, in relation to books written by men, or a critique of that work, and secondly, with relation to work written by women. And let me say something about that first. I think that the critic and the writer have very different tasks, the woman writer and the feminist critic, who may be also a woman or now beginning to be sometimes a man. I think that the first obligation that the feminist critic has towards women's writing is to buy it, mm-hmm. to support it. This has really happened through the women's movement. There has always been a very good audience for this work, but now I think there's also a serious academic audience supporting it. And when you have that supportive environment, creative artists are encouraged to produce their best work. I don't think we should be dictating to women novelists what their subject matter ought to be or what positions they take towards it.
You mean as a group of theorists?
As a group of theorists, which yeah. I think this is where ideology enters. And I think it's happened in England, for example, where feminist critics have very often said they're not satisfied with the women writers they have.
I see.
They're not feminist enough. Mm-hmm. They're not choosing the topics that feminist critics would like to see them working on. And there are some American women writers, too, who don't see this as their mission. That isn't our task. Our task is to respond to their work, to understand it, to discuss it from an objective mm-hmm. position. Their subjective task is to create as fully and as finely as they can.
Elaine, what about male writers?
Yeah, here I think there is a more ideological factor. I think that we do criticize ideologically as well as aesthetically the work of male writers, and I think in the United States this is necessary. American literature traditionally has been a male literature. It has been a literature which celebrates male values and marginalizes female values. A literature of pioneers who go out, who wrestle with the wilderness, who wrestle with the white whale and the bear and the Indian, and who dominate, and whose heroism consists in large part of their getting away from women. I think in many ways American male literature is still immature in this respect, and I do find that immature, that it has not confronted the full meaning of what the society represents and all of its, the experience of all of its people.
It's not what? Androgynous?
Well, I wouldn't want to say androgynous. Androgynous to me is a kind of a wishy-washy term. I mean, I believe in masculinity and femininity as mm-hmm. as independent experiences and values, but I don't think you can have a literature that neglects one and valorizes the other, as so much American men's writing has done, or even worse, is contemptuous of the other. Androgyny would be a mixture of both, and I think that's mm-hmm. a kind of utopian projection that eliminates the strength and power that both men and women get from a gendered experience.
Are you saying separate but equal?
No, I'm not saying so much separate but equal in the political sense. Uh-huh. But I am saying that whereas in the early days of feminist criticism, I think ideologically we wanted to deny difference, we wanted to stress equality, which is what one does in the political arena.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk about equal rights, then you must talk about equality as citizens within a republic. But when you discuss culture, when you discuss psychology, equality is not the best term. There is difference within culture, there's difference within the family, there's difference within people's personal lives that have to do with whether or not they're men or women. And as critics, we recognize those differences. We talk about the ways they're reflected in literature. But as teachers, too, we have to protest, and we do protest, against a cultural heritage that we've been passing on to our students, which says women are unimportant. War, killing, hunting are the only things that matter, and a literature that doesn't deal with these things is trivial mm-hmm. and not worthy of study.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the concluding segment in a series of conversations about women's literary studies. My guest is Elaine Showalter, professor of English at Rutgers University. Elaine Showalter is the author of books and articles about feminism and literature. At present, she's a member of the editorial board of the forthcoming edition of the Cambridge History of American Literature. Let's talk about some figures in American literature, male or female writers. Maybe you could pick a few. I'm thinking, in the 19th century, Mark mm-hmm. Twain, Hawthorne, Melville, Emily Dickinson, people like that. Is it fair to go back and look at those works and say, because there is no emphasis on women, or because, as you say, there's an indifference to women, or because these writers are obsessed with purely male, quote-unquote, concerns, does that make of them lesser writers?
No, it doesn't. And I should explain that what I'm saying is not that we should stop reading, mm-hmm. God forbid, Mark Twain or Melville or any of the great writers in our national tradition. I think it's more of a question of adding to it mm-hmm. the other perspective, which is the perspective of women's culture. And if we take the decade of the 1850s in the United States, for example, which is called the American Renaissance, this is a period in which we had, I think, one of the great novels of our culture, Uncle Tom's Cabin, written by Harriet Beecher Stowe. And yet, this is a novel which has not been taught in the United States.
You sound like Leslie Fiedler.
Yeah, Fiedler is certainly one of the critics who's rediscovered it. Mm-hmm. He talks about the inadvertent epic and the novels that dealt with female experience and that dealt with the problem of race mm-hmm. in this country, which have not really been the books that were included in the literary canon as masterpieces, in part because ideas of literary history were formed around male values and around white male values. So what I'm saying is not that we discard Melville, but that we look again at the models of literary history that create a kind of zero-sum game. Say, if we're going to teach Melville, we can't teach Stowe. There isn't room for Stowe, or there isn't a place for Stowe because we've defined the masterpiece in a certain way and she doesn't fit it. I think she's a very exciting writer who is, in fact, now being rediscovered. Another person in that generation would be Margaret Fuller, mm-hmm. one of the first significant American intellectuals and feminist theorists who died tragically before she was 40 years old, and who has always been subordinated in literary history to Emerson, mm-hmm. with whom she makes a very natural pair. If we move on later, we could look at Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman as two models of the direction that the American poetic tradition took. But even though now we have a great revival of interest in Dickinson, and she has always, I think, been respected as a great poet, it's really very recently that she's been acknowledged as someone who needs to be taught alongside of Whitman as one of the masters mm-hmm. of an American literary poetic. Literary history, when it's done on a national basis, is the expression of the history of a people. It's not simply a set of literary judgments. It is as much history as it is criticism.
So are you criticizing the literature itself or the mindset that the critics bring to it?
I'm criticizing the mindset because literature never was simply white and male. Mm-hmm. There's a real gap between the writing that takes place in any period and the literary history, which is a kind of fiction mm-hmm. that's constructed after the fact that selects and discriminates and awards prizes and ranks. Certainly in the 19th century, there were as many and perhaps more women writing novels than men. Hawthorne talks about the damned mob of scribbling women who were selling mm-hmm. while he was struggling. They entered, Nina Baim, who is a professor of American literature at the University of Illinois, has mm-hmm. a wonderful essay about this called Melodramas of Beset Manhood, in which she explains that American women writers entered literary history as the enemy. Uh-huh. They were the ones who were selling, who were reaching a large public, where the male writers who thought of themselves as artists were despised, were failures, were commercially struggling and flopping and having to turn to other kinds of jobs to make a living. Literary historians in the academy themselves were men. They were concerned with establishing a national literature that could contend with English literature, to break away, and they looked to what they saw as the strongest tradition. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to quarrel with that on that basis entirely. Certainly Melville and Hawthorne are great novelists. Hawthorne is someone who speaks very eloquently about the situation of women in his novels. But if we're talking about really the shape of a nation, the development of a nation, then we have to be able to understand that women's culture.
Elaine, you say that in the 19th century, women were viewed as the enemy in the literary enterprise. Well, things have changed.
Yes.
What's going on in feminist literary theory and criticism? What are the issues that occupy the feminist writers?
First of all, the question of influence. Uh-huh. How does a woman writer who comes to her profession as someone educated in a male tradition, someone exposed to the masterpieces of the past that were mostly written by men, how does she define her own position? What is her psychology, in a way, as a creative artist? Is she both the daughter of these fathers and the daughter of literary mothers and grandmothers mm-hmm. who have been repressed and obscured? How does she rediscover the female side of her past? In connection with that, too, does a woman who is writing, even today, feel a kind of anxiety about the aggression, the mm-hmm. egoism that's involved in the artist's role? Many feminist theorists have suggested that writing itself is a kind of male act, or metaphorically a male act, in the sense that it involves confidence in the self, an assertiveness of the ego, the wish to put one's own fantasies and words before a public. It's a kind of exposure, a self-exposure.
It's an act of reproduction.
It is an act of reproduction, and it can be seen and has often been seen in literary history as rivaling the biological mm-hmm. reproduction, the biological creativity, which seems more natural to women. So you often get this metaphor, do you give birth to a child or a book? Yeah. In many women's lives in the past and the present, too, there's a real conflict about whether you can do both. Does one eliminate the other? If you have children, do you have time to be a serious artist? Mm-hmm. If you are a serious artist, do you use up in some way the generative capacities that might go towards bearing and raising children.
Elaine Showalter, let's conclude. Tell me one book, one essay, one poem that that a general audience should read, should know about, something that comes to mind that you would point to and say, here's a good example of what's going on in feminism and literature today.
Can I say two? Can
sure.
I name two? I would name as a novel one that I'm very closely connected with, so perhaps I have a hidden agenda. It's a novel by Joyce Carol Oates called A Bloodsmore Romance, mm-hmm. which came out 2 years ago and is now available in paperback and can be picked up anywhere, I think. And my concern with it, in part, is because it's dedicated to me, and I'm a character in it, a very minor character. I really sort of have a walk-on part at the very end.
Do you live or die? Do you get killed?
Why? Oh, I live. I'm running for president. Oh, I have a great part in the book. But what's really exciting about the book, and I never saw it until it was done, so I shouldn't say I have any hand in it, but that I something I feel enormously proud and thrilled to be named in. It's a work by a contemporary women writer, which is a kind of modern revision of 19th century American women's writing. Takes the plot of Little Women, the five sisters, and deals with it in contemporary feminist terms. It's set in the 19th century, but it comes from a modern sensibility. And it takes the lives of these five daughters and follows them all through, and through a wonderful combination of fantasy and satire gives them the chance to live out their fullest possibilities as 19th century women never could do. So that one becomes an actress and another an inventor. One actually turns into a man. One is a spiritualist.
What do you mean
novelist.
One turns into a man?
Well, this is one of the fantasy elements in the book. Mm-hmm. She runs away on her wedding night, and by a mysterious process that the narrator of the novel simply can't understand, she goes off to the Wild West and gradually does turn into a man. I mean, the book is a combination of romance and the occult.
Isn't that a little depressing to a feminist literary critic, if you want to keep the sexes separate, as you said earlier?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think this is a comic novel.
Okay.
And it suggests the various possibilities of how women might want to live their lives. And it is set in the 19th century. It ends on the last day of the 19th century in 1899. For a woman in the 19th century who wanted to be a Mississippi riverboat gambler, there was only one way to do it. You had to be a man. And that's what this woman wants to do. And that's how she ends up. She has a terrific life. She's a sort of desperado in the Wild West. And those times you had to be a man to do it, and that's the frame of the book. In the 20th century, we have other ways of realizing some of those fantasies. So that's a book I admire very much by someone who I think is a brilliantly gifted contemporary woman writer.
The Bloodsmore Romance.
Bloodsmore Romance by Joyce Carol Oates.
All right.
The other book, I think if I were going to suggest one book of feminist criticism, it would be The Mad Woman in the Attic by Sandra Gilbert and Susan Gubar, which is published by Yale University Press and is also in paperback, and is a wonderfully rich and exciting and original and very brilliant examination of 19th century women writers, both American and English, from the perspective of influence that I was talking about, that tries to look at what they call the anxiety of authorship in the experience of these women writers, how they confronted a male literary heritage and how they redefined it in female terms, and the codes, in fact, of women's writing, how we can decipher the symbolism of this writing, which in part describes their anxiety about being women writing at all. It's a wonderful book. It was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, and that I think everyone would enjoy.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the third and concluding segment in a series of conversations about women's literary studies. My guest was Elaine Showalter, professor of English at Rutgers University. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about the quality of undergraduate education in American colleges and universities. The panelists will be Ernestine Friedel, Dean of Arts and Sciences at Duke University, William Bennett, Chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and Sam Williamson,
Dean of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible